You're listening to the 20th episode of the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. I'm your host, Jace Kraft, and today I'm introducing you to another Olympian. Jessica O'Connell competed in the 2016 Olympic Games, placing 26th in the 5K. She has had numerous world championship appearances, including a top 10 finish in the indoor 3K and event she is currently the Canadian record holder in. Jess doesn't have just the speed in her legs, though. She has the brains to back it up. I'm sure you'll pick that up in our interview today. She has a master's in exercise physiology, has worked as a research assistant in many kinesiology projects at the University of Calgary as well. Today, we are going to explore the differences between anaerobic and aerobic exercise and how you should recover from each and the science behind tapering and peaking for a major event. Let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Jess. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, I want to start with your athletic background. And I know you have a background in, the science and the research as well. But every scientist has in the athletic field has an athletic background. And you especially kind of have that athlete first in kind of probably the eyes of social media and that kind of stuff. So let's start there. By my understanding, you started in dancing as a sport first. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was not an athletic child. I couldn't kick a soccer ball. I scored one goal in community soccer when I was in kindergarten. It was on my own team.
It's easier that way.
yeah, apparently. Yeah, that's my teammates didn't agree. I took swimming lessons and I was like a really, really scrawny child and I was afraid to put my head underwater. So I couldn't pass the level where you had to like blow bubbles. So athletics were not a strong part of my upbringing. I was born in the era of river dance and my last name is O'Connell. My grandpa is from Ireland. And so my parents put me into Irish dancing. It was very popular in my elementary school at the time.
Yeah.
And I really took to it. There's competitive Irish dancing. And so I competed and practiced and performed and stuff for about 10 years, all through grade school.
Wow. So what age did you start Irish dancing?
I would say I was about 8 or 9.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were competitive Irish dancing then up till, how long did you say up in high school even, or?
Yeah. Until I graduated high school.
Okay. What is an Irish dance competition entail look like?
So you have to do 3 different dances. They're about 2 minutes long. There are 2 types of shoes, soft shoes that are kind of like ballet slippers and hard shoes that are more like tap dancing shoes. And so you do 2 hard shoe dances and 1 soft shoe dance. And it's really, really aerobic. Like you're jumping around. You don't use your arms much, which probably contributed to my wonky running style. you're jumping, you're kicking your legs, you're moving your feet really, really fast. So I think this played a role in my future athletic career, which I'm sure we'll get into. Because I was basically training without realizing I was training.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And 2 episodes ago, we had Ryan Atkins on and he got his athletic start in unicycling.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, interesting how like, even like that's so like out there, but it kind of correlates to his success in OCR now because he has the balance and that kind of stuff. And it was aerobic. And now like talking with you, you had that background in dancing. That led you into kind of that aerobic fitness, which then when you took to running helped, springboard there, but it started with something totally different. I mean, you weren't like running as
9-year-old competitively. No.
So that sounds really out there, but Shannon Robery, who's a very famous American middle distance runner, like multi-time Olympian, and Gabriella Dubois Stafford, who is a Canadian Olympian, Canadian record holder in like every event from the 1500 to the 5K, also grew up doing Irish dancing. Really? So I think there's something there.
Interesting. All right. Parents, enroll your kids in Irish dancing.
Yes.
Do you have to be Irish?
You do not have to be Irish. Okay.
Cool. So you attribute this dancing to kind of the start of your running career as far as having that aerobic base. When did you get into running? Because it wasn't right away in high school, was it?
No. So I would always join my school teams. So in junior high and high school, I'd always compete for the school, but it's a lot lower key in Canada than it is in the States. Sure. So the school team was kind of like run club, like you'd go to a few practices and then go to a meet or two at the end of the year. So I started training with a club, an outside group in fall of grade 11. So my junior year of high school.
Cool. So then the club, was that like you're going to road races and stuff, or were you going to track meets? Like how was it structured? Cause like here in the States, when, you know, you compete for your school, you have state and you have regionals and, you know, you kind of have that like championship. Was it the same with club in Canada?
It's similar. I would almost replace club in Canada with high school athletics in the States. So you're going to different levels of meets. I went to junior nationals in cross country and track. The biggest difference would be that you're not limited to high school competitions. So I was able to compete in some like very elite, like open meets when I was in high school as well.
Yeah, that's cool. As a high schooler, I grew up in a small town in South Dakota, and I was only competing against high schoolers in my class, and it was very limited competition. So it's cool to have like that flexibility as a high schooler. When did you know that like running was going to be a long time sport for you?
So I was very lucky to become a lot better at running quickly once I started training with the club. Because I was sort of like very raw and untapped when I joined from my dancing. And in that year, so after about 8 months of training, because I joined in November, that summer, my coach brought me to junior nationals. And there was sort of a point of contention because I was so new to running and I was technically a youth aged athlete, which is like a age group too young. You could still compete, but I would have more chances in the future and stuff. And he wasn't sure if I was ready for that level of competition, but I convinced him I was because I was so used to competing in Irish dancing, and I competed in big things before, like North Americans and worlds and stuff. And to be honest, I didn't do that well. So I was used to failure on a big stage. And so we convinced him that I was mature enough. He brought me, and I ended up PBing in every race I ran. I came third in the 800 and the 1500. And this blew my mind because, again, I literally didn't even think that I was a good enough runner to like wear spandex or own spikes, because that's what the fast girls did. And I had like a severe case of imposter syndrome. I did get those things, but I was like worried that I was sort of like faking it till I made it, but I actually made it and I could not believe it. And so that's when I was like, wow, okay, cool. It turns out that I'm good at this. This is amazing. I really like this. And I definitely want to keep going.
What about like, so I think when, especially younger athletes, when they get into a situation like that where they're maybe a little bit over their heads, but they don't really realize it as far as competition, they like have breakout races. I mean, in like my career, I can think of my seventh grade year in cross country, and I was running in high school, level, and I was ranked like 80th coming into the state meet, but I got 25th because I was running in the 20s like all year in the high school meets. I just like figured that's what I'd get at state. I didn't like put it together that I should be running back. Did you feel kind of that afterwards, now looking back, that like, okay, I probably shouldn't have ran as good as I did. I just didn't know any better.
Hugely. I was so raw and fresh, and I had never tasted failure yet. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know anything other than to just go out and run really hard and take risks. Like I, there's no outcome that I can imagine except to like completely exhaust myself because I wanted to fit in and I didn't want to embarrass myself, which like now with all the races under my belt that I've done, like there's so many more layers to racing. It's like I'm now a seasoned veteran, which is like good, but also bad because now I have fear of failure and I didn't have that then.
Yeah, that's my next question. Like, how do you tap into that, that mindset where like, I can run with these guys, or like not having that fear of running with somebody and like you were when you were younger?
It was more like the perception of, I can't run with these guys. Okay. Don't screw it up. To be honest.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. I think that I decided somehow that I wasn't afraid, and like failure wouldn't be as big of a, like that big of a deal. I just wanted to go for it.
For sure. So putting yourself out there and not like being devastated if you go out too hard and die and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. We had a bit of an advantage too. I'm from Alberta, which is like track isn't quite as deep in Alberta as somewhere like Ontario, a different province with a huger population. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit blinded as to how the rest of the country was. And so I was used to doing well in Alberta. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know where I ranked in the rest of Canada. And so there were no pre-existing like pecking orders or anything like that for me to concern myself with.
Yeah. Do you find it now like coming in? Because obviously in the professional level, you know, everybody that's going to be running, you know, their times, they have a history usually. And you kind of able to put that pecking order before the race starts. Do you think that has an effect on like where you actually end up then? Do you think like if you were coming in blind and didn't know anybody that you would run faster?
I think it depends on who they are. Like if they are night and day faster than me, like some of the people who are meddling at the Olympics and stuff like that, mm-hmm. I know I can't run with them. And so, yes, I absolutely put myself behind them. And that's probably smart because I will literally implode if I try and race with them. But other athletes that on paper have maybe beat me before, but their personal bests are within the realm of what I can run, that is really exciting in a race because then I know that I can work with them and I know that I can take advantage of their abilities and I know they're going to run well. And so if I just stick on as best as I can, I'll run well too. So there's some empowerment that comes with that now.
Cool. So tell me about 2015, because from what I understand, this was kind of like your maybe breakout, or you're having your best kind of season of your life at this point. The Olympics are next year. Obviously you would have to have your eyes on that. And then you start to have some Achilles issues early in the year or mid year that put a damper on the rest of your season. Tell me, well, first of all, before we get into 2016 and the Olympics, how was that just from like a mental standpoint? How did you work through that?
It was really stressful. Yeah. So 2014 was my first year of running at I don't know, world-class is the right term, like a level that would qualify me for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, great, just have to maintain this for two more years. Easier said than done. So yeah. 2015 started out even stronger. I'd built on the previous year's racing and training. And then I was over in Europe living the dream. I had this amazing race circuit that brought me to Vienna and then Germany and then Morocco and Oslo. Like just that is the dream. That was my dream, like racing internationally all over the place.
Yeah.
And as soon as I came home, I strained my Achilles kind of out of the blue, but history has now showed me that I often get hurt after big travel. I don't know, like often I'm racing or training really hard and I don't recover well. And so that's something that's been a pattern ever since. Sure. So it was really disarming because I just reached this level and become this athlete that I'd really always dreamed of. And I knew that I was now capable, but all of a sudden that was taken away with an injury, not taken away, but greatly, greatly changed.
Yeah.
So it was hard. It was stressful. I competed in the Pan Am Games that summer. It went very poorly. Then found out I had tears in my Achilles, dropped out of the World Championships, which was my first Worlds, which was a bummer because I'd wanted to use it as some prep for the Olympics. Yeah. And then ended up rehabbing for the entire summer, part of the fall, and then healed, and then again hurt something that spring, leading right into the Olympics. So all just very overwhelming because there's a lot of stress and pressure anyway. And then to have this injury layered on top when I knew I could be there, but now there was this like extraneous curveball that was thrown at me. It was just hard to manage emotions and keep my head on straight, I guess.
Yeah. From a physical standpoint, what were you doing to, I mean, obviously coming in 2016, you made the Olympic team. So you had to have some sort of fitness throughout the whole injury and then coming up out of it. What were you doing during those times to stay fit and kind of rehab that injury to get back to 100% where you can make the Olympic team?
First and foremost, I work with a really good physiotherapist. So I think it's important if you have a long-term injury to find someone great that can just be in your corner and that you trust, because there's a huge, huge range of abilities in different therapists, and maybe you shop around or maybe you see different people for different things, but you need someone, like you need to take your health into your own control with the help of others. And then I was also cross training really, really hard. So I would be in the pool or on the elliptical. Those were my two favorites for a lot of hours doing different cross training workouts. You hear lots of stories of athletes cross training and coming back as stronger than they were before. And so that gave me a lot of hope. I was like, well, if it's worked for them, I'm just going to work my butt off. And like, why wouldn't it work for me?
Yeah. So in the pool, were you doing like an underwater treadmill, or was it like swimming, or what were you doing there?
Mostly water running. So if you're not familiar, it's like, it's almost like doggy paddling. It's like upright running in the water, kind of a running motion as hard as you can, flailing, really just trying to get your heart rate high.
Moving your limbs.
Yes, exactly. Very boring. I wouldn't recommend it for fun, but it works.
Can you do Irish dancing in the pool?
You probably could. I haven't tried yet.
Cool. So you come back into the Olympic season now. Talk to us. You're coming out of your injury and into the Olympic trials, making the team. Like, how did that all happen?
So with the spring injury, it was a calf strain that happened when I was at altitude camp, and right prior to the racing season starting. So this was extra stressful because I had a limited amount of time and meets possible for me to run a time standard. So I had to run a certain time in order to be eligible. And I had actually run that time the year before, so I was technically qualified, but Canada had a condition that you had to prove that you were still fit. Okay. So one of the conditions of me qualifying for my own country was that I had to run this time by a certain date.
Okay.
And meets kept passing and I wasn't ready. So it's like, this is a big problem. Like, there's no point in competing before you're ready, because you'll just set yourself back. And so that's one of the hardest parts of being an elite athlete is that you have to be really choosy in where you put your energy and your efforts, because you only have so many races in you. And so you just have to like make a lot of decisions on only pieces of information and just hope that you're the best one. And so we chose to wait until the very last meet, really, that was possible for me to run this time qualifying. I think I had to run under 15:25, and I did. I ran 15:24 point something.
Wow.
Just stuck under, thank goodness. And then I was healthy again and good to go. So it did work out, thankfully. But it was, it was harder than I was expecting to be able to manage the fear that came with the injury at the time, because the pressure was high and there were very clear timelines that I had to meet.
Yeah. And it was kind of, you coming down to that last race, it's all or nothing. It's not only all or nothing, it's all or nothing on time. You know, did you have, like, was that a race where you won the event and you had to keep pushing, or was there enough competition that you were kind of just hanging on to people and going?
I can't remember. I remember Kim Connolly being in the race, and I can't remember what place I was. I always get race amnesia. I can never remember after. Really? I think I had to make sure it would happen. And so I think, I don't forget if I was with Kim or if I was a bit behind, but I had to be like, okay, like, this is the pace I have to run. I have to run this. And so I remember pushing a bit, but that night at the track, I had teammates and Canadian friends and stuff. They were everywhere, because a lot of Canadians were competing at that meet. They were, it felt like they were every 10 meters cheering me on. It was the coolest thing. So there was, it was a really good atmosphere, and that made it a lot easier to stay on task and just, like, make it happen.
For sure. So out of all of those injuries leading up to the Olympics and your career now, you know, up to 2020, what's kind of the biggest takeaway as far as from a, like, a recovery standpoint when it comes to injury in sport?
So I've had a lot of injuries since then. Pretty much every year I have some sort of catastrophic Achilles episode that takes me out for a few months. So since then, it's not like my career has been really smooth either. And I would say that cross training really works. So if a goal enough is important enough to you to want to keep pushing towards it and keep working hard, and it's very meaningful, then if you dedicate yourself to cross training, you can stay fit. And I think it's important to remember that you can heal from any injury unless, like, I don't know, something horrifically catastrophic has happened. So often you see athletes just get stuck and they kind of give up, or they're really miserable and they're not healing. Well, then you need to look at it really objectively and figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. If someone's told you can run, but every step is painful, maybe you shouldn't run. Like, you need to take, you need to be in control of your own life and figure out, like, you need to be assertive.
Yeah. I think sometimes in, like, the medical community, us as patients or consumers, we forget that, like, we are the consumer and we can choose who, you know, treats us. And because there is difference, like you said before, in PTs, there's different talents of, you know, who you go see and stuff. And that stuff really matters. So,
if you stick around and listen to enough of our episodes here on the Science of Sports Recovery podcast, you'll notice a common theme of importance of mobility in recovery and injury prevention. That's why I recommend checking out the Ready States Virtual Mobility Coach to help you improve your mobility, recoverability, and injury prevention. The Ready State is a brainchild of coach and athlete Dr. Kelly Starrett, who you can learn more about on episode 13. His virtual mobility coach program helps athletes understand the importance of recovery, pain relief, and self-care. In other words, it helps fix the recovery side of training so you can keep seeing results from your workouts. His program will guide you through the same mobilizations used on athletes in the NFL, NHL, and MLB, provide custom tools for pain relief, give you customized pre and post exercise mobilizations based on your training and sports schedule, and deliver daily mobilizations to keep you on track to achieve your goals. You put your heart and soul into your workouts. Make sure you get the most of them by going to thereadystate.com/Jace. Again, that's thereadystate.com/JASE. The link will also be in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
Well, let's get into your research background, and because I know you like reading research, and that's obviously what you have your master's in and everything. Mm-hmm. So before we get into kind of the publishings that like you've had, I want to talk about like what is your like biggest from all of your I want to make sure I phrase this right.
Sure.
From all the research that you've done from an athlete's perspective, what has been like the most game changing when it comes to impacting on how you recover or how you train or how you treat your body from the research standpoint?
I think my answer would actually be the opposite. I think one of the biggest mistakes that people will do is take a piece of research and think that that's biblical,
yeah,
or that it will give them that extra. They think that the 1% they'll gain from the piece of research or the fad or the thing is worth 50% or 100%. That's sure. going to be the game changing piece. Yep. And from what I've seen at the end of the day, a lot of research really proves what good coaching does anyway. Like, mm-hmm. I love doing VO2 max tests because I love seeing my numbers and stuff. I mean, I've studied this stuff. I know what they all mean. I like seeing yeah. how I'm changing, like as an athlete and as a researcher. But every time I do one, we realize, oh yeah, the pace that I would think to be a tempo pace is actually what I'm doing naturally. Mm-hmm. The pace that I'm doing VO2 max intervals at is actually what I've always been doing. It confirms what I've been doing in training rather than sure. changing it. So I think that people get really caught up in things that are new and exciting, and mm-hmm. often some things really are game changing, like good nutrition after workouts or the power of sleep, stuff like that. But yeah. often if something's really crazy and buzzy and stuff, like there's a catch, because like sometimes it is too good to be true.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I always point out when like I'm doing when I study the research and stuff, it's like a lot of times they'll have, you know, 14 or 24 or, you know, 48 participants in this study. Mm-hmm. And they say like, oh, it works because it worked for, you know, 70 or 80%. And then mm-hmm. it was a strong enough correlation that they say this is, you know, works, and they blanket for everybody. But there was, you know, a portion of that 10%, 15% of it, like that didn't work mm-hmm. for, you know, mm-hmm. so it goes like everybody is different. Mm-hmm. And you really got to like, I think you take the research as more of like, this could work for me, or ideation yeah. of training, and then mm-hmm. test it on yourself. And, yeah. and see if it works and if you feel a difference. And if you do, great, keep doing that. If not, well, you know, maybe it's not for you. But that doesn't mean that the research isn't valid. That doesn't mean that you're not like, you know, a normal human being. It's just everybody's different. But
yeah. And in the same way, sometimes things will statistically show no effect, but research or performance is improved by like 0.5%, which in a race is massive. Like,
yeah.
So there is like a clinical significance versus a real life significance. So I think the biggest mistake that's happening is that the people doing the research and the sporting community aren't talking, or mm-hmm. they're just a little bit too separate. So I would love to see more collaboration or more. It's hard because coaching culture isn't always science culture, but
more, yeah, like exactly. a
stronger link between that.
Yeah, I think the scientists want to say, no, this is true, because, you know, it's kind of like a black and white community, I feel, mm-hmm. not as in color or race or whatever, but as in like, yeah. it's either this way or it's this way. It's true yes. or false. There's no in between. Whereas coaching's more of kind of like the art of putting the black and white and making gray together. Yes. so you've studied a lot of like the VO2 component and then how that affects with aerobic to anaerobic exercising and training and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about your research and what like a slow component of oxygen uptake even is? And we'll kind of talk about why you picked this topic and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I never talk about my research, so this is kind of fun. So I studied like a proposed mechanism behind the slow component of oxygen uptake. So what the heck is that? So basically, if you're exercising at an intensity that's above your lactate threshold, but below your VO2 max, so something like 10K pace, for example, we'll just assume 10K pace.
And that's or not something changing. You could sustain for like 40 minutes.
Yeah, or like 30 minutes. Or 40 minutes. Yeah. So assume your pace isn't changing. Mm-hmm. So in theory, you're, sorry, let me backtrack. You're above lactate threshold. So what that means is your pace isn't changing. However, the lactate in your blood is going up and up and up. Your lactate is accumulating because you're doing enough anaerobic metabolism to start to accumulate lactate in your blood. Sure. That'll build and build. However, since your pace isn't changing, you would think that maybe you wouldn't be taking in more oxygen, but you are. Your VO2 rises, your pace is not rising, your lactate's rising, your VO2 is rising. So why is that? No one knows exactly why your oxygen uptake rises if your work rate isn't. And so it's always been thought it's because you're building lactate, you're becoming fatigued, you need more energy to get rid of waste products, blah, blah, blah. The, basically, the task is getting harder. And so we looked at the rate that the lactate is being produced at. So lactate is a good marker for anaerobic metabolism. It shows how much anaerobic metabolism is happening to give you energy. What we saw is that the rate of lactate production was actually becoming less as time went on. So your anaerobic energy contribution to the task was becoming smaller. And so because of that, your aerobic contribution was becoming larger to meet the same actual energy demand. Except for it cost slightly more energy as time went on because you, the athlete was breathing harder. And so their respiratory muscles cost a little bit more energy, but the actual task otherwise didn't.
Sure. So because the anaerobic system, that would be what you could say, like you're using high carb type energy form that, you know, in theory runs out over time, and then you start using fat uptake, which is a higher source of energy per gram or whatever.
So that's why you would use the carbs first.
So would you said like lactic starts getting produced less, but you would think, you know, towards the end of your run, like your legs are burning. So is it just because there's so much buildup on that, or is it something that, that like lactic's not correlating with burn in muscle?
Probably a bit of both. So the rate of lactate production is less, is what we saw.
Okay.
However, the amount of lactate in your blood is increasing. So you're producing it at a smaller rate, but it's still building and accumulating. So yes, you're getting more and more lactate in your muscles, and that's causing that burning sensation. Also, you're tired. So you've got some hydrogen ions, you've got some waste products floating around. Like that fatigue and energy cost are not the same thing.
Okay, that makes sense. So your findings on this, what does that mean to an athlete or to a coach? Is there any like takeaways from this?
From a sport application standpoint, not really, to be honest. It was more the point of the project, and it was based on quite a few assumptions, but it was really more to look at like a mechanism of a physiological process and just sort of understand how the body works better. So if that could later be applied to sports somehow, that would be amazing. But this was mostly in the discovery mode or the like uncovering of how things work, not the, okay, now do this mode.
For sure. Yeah. So like, you're trying to discover the body and how that works. Like, why is that important to potentially training, or, you know, just as in the science, I mean, the sporting community, like, why go after some of these findings?
I mean, I didn't do the research because I'm an athlete. I'm interested in it because I'm an athlete, but I didn't do it necessarily to help athletics. But sure. I think that it's really important to know why you're doing something and to always be able to justify why. At least I think so.
Okay.
Other athletes don't need that, and that is good. And they probably think a lot less than I do, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But
yeah.
In training, you should know what sort of adaptation or what sort of system you're trying to hit, because if you don't, then you may be wasting your efforts, or maybe you're actually not training as well as you could. Like, there needs to be a plan. You shouldn't train based on emotion. You should train based on a plan, something objective, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it gives you kind of, in my perspective, like, some of these research, it gives you confidence in what you're doing is right. And like you said, kind of in the beginning of the research conversation, where a lot of it's confirming, like, okay, my tempo pace should be this. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's what it was, you know. But then you can start to correlate, like, okay, this is how I feel. This is like how my body is feeling during this time. And then you can kind of correlate that with, okay, this is the adaptation I'm going to have when my body feels like this. And then kind of take that into, like, say, you know, because, like, tempo pace, it's one thing flat, it's another thing uphill or downhill or into the wind, or, you know, and then you can start basing off effort rather than timed rigidity. Totally. which I think is important as an athlete.
But totally agree.
Cool. So as when it comes to recovery, what is your kind of recovery routine like when you get done with a hard workout or a race? Like, what does Jess do to make sure that she comes back next week or next workout feeling fresh and ready to go?
It's pretty simple and boring. I always do a cool down, even if I don't want to, even if it's a hard day or I'm tired or it was a bad race, always do a cool down, get back on the horse.
Your cool down is just running, or do you incorporate anything else into that?
Oh yeah, sorry, just jogging, just a few minutes of jogging.
Okay, cool.
And then as soon as I can, after a hard effort, and sorry, this may be before a cool down, if I've done a really hard interval workout, I'm always eating something that's high in carbs. So might be like a cookie or a granola bar or a normal bar. I'm a big fan of SlimFast, not for its slimming benefits, okay. Please no, but because it's like a nice cheap powder and it has the perfect recovery ratio of 4-to-1 carbs to protein.
Okay.
And it's really cheap and it's a powder. You just add water, boom, boom, easy. So I always prioritize getting in some sort of fuel immediately after something hard. Okay. Right after a hard workout, that's when your body is the most receptive to fuel and to the carbs and protein to rebuild all the damage that you've just done. So gotta maximize that. I make sure to eat a good meal pretty soon after, a few hours after, maybe depending on the time of day, but making sure that I have something available. If I'm training in the evening, then I make sure I've already cooked a meal so I don't have to get home and then spend an hour, like, I don't know, like roasting fish or something like that. Like that's a waste of time and energy then, because I gotta prioritize recovering. Mm-hmm. I try and sleep a good amount. I sleep about 8 hours a night. I'm not a big napper because I'm busy and high strung, but I wish that I was more of a napper. And that's about it. I do a lot of rolling with a trigger point ball. I have a really cool thing called the Zen Roller, which is sort of a like robot massager.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I get a lot of manual therapy. So that's also good for helping my muscles recover, but none of that would matter if I'm not eating and sleeping.
Sure. Cool. So you've had to like, you know, with world championships and Olympics and some of like these big races, it comes to a point where you have to like taper and peak, you know, for, and those that aren't familiar with the term taper, essentially it just means cutting back on some training load. So then you're 100% fresh and 100% fit at a certain date and time. What does that process kind of look like for you, and how have you developed that over the years? Is it like based on how you feel during that stage of training, or is it like more scientific, like 20% of mileage cut or volume or anything like that?
Well, my coach isn't a big math guy. So I think he knows about things like reduce your mileage by X percent and stuff like that. But he's never out there with a calculator to being like, okay, Jess, make sure you only run 47.5 minutes today because we're 6 days out from the race or anything like that.
Yeah.
I've followed a very similar taper for the last few years because it seems to work. And I think that there's some value in repeatability. Like, doesn't need to be rocket science. Sometimes when I'm coaching athletes, I feel like it's tempting to like want to always make things different and new, but they don't need to be. I always do the same taper workout, a bit of stuff at race pace, greatly reduced in volume, but still keep the intensity there. In the week leading up, and really taper my runs off. Keep my nutrition about the same. I may naturally be a bit less hungry, so I may eat a little less, but I don't really think about it. One important thing that I always do is my good luck ritual, which is I always have an ice cream the day before my race. Very important for performance. In a taper week, the biggest things are reducing volume by quite a bit, but keeping the intensity there.
Okay. For the athletes that you coach, do you kind of keep that same philosophy, or is it like different for athletes? Do some need to keep more intensity and or volume and then less, or is it pretty much the same across the board?
An exception would be for an athlete who's racing like literally every weekend, which some do in the OCR community. They race all the time, and there we probably wouldn't taper quite as much because none of the races are these big peak races. But for athletes that race a few times a season, which would be similar to what I do, then I always give a pretty good taper. Athletes have this tendency to overwork, and they're just workhorses. They feel like they're getting stuff done and they're getting better when they're putting in more and more and more and more time. But I think it's really silly to show up to a race line fatigued when you only get so many races and you never know what's going to happen. So you may as well be in the best position to do well.
Yeah. So what about like an high school athlete or a college athlete that, you know, their schedule is racing every weekend and then up to like the end of the year meet? Do you just like not taper for any of the meets until the end, or like how do you kind of structure that?
Yeah, if they're racing every single weekend, then to a peak, I think I would just rearrange the schedule a bit. So I would consider a race to be, it's a race, it's an all out effort, but in my head, I would plan that as a workout or a hard session. And then maybe one other hard session later in the week, maybe in the middle, so that they've got some recovery from the event. And then they're building into the next race, recovered again, but they get some work done in the middle of the week.
What about working out after a race, like in early season or mid season? You ever do that or ever recommend that?
It's so trendy now, these after race workouts where you see athletes running these crazy PBs and then popping out a workout.
Yeah.
And I can see the temptation because you feel so good after a race. Like often you feel like a rock star.
Yeah.
And then it's in the hours and days after that you feel like total garbage. But I don't do it, and I don't give it to athletes because I would want all of my focus to be on the race. And I think that when you're in that like kind of inflated rock star mode, like there's a chance to overdo it, or like you've already exerted 100%. Why do you need to give more? but I can totally respect that other coaches would see things differently and would give it to their athletes. Like, it's just a difference in training philosophy, but that doesn't mean it's wrong.
For sure. Cool. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time here, but I do have some questions from the audience of Science of Sports Recovery. I send out a email or post it on Instagram. So if you're listening and you're like, how do I get questions to my future guests? Those would be the two places to reach out to me or to follow me. But these questions are meant to be, you know, 60 seconds or less. Some are fun, some are serious, and just to get to know just the athlete and human a little bit more. So first question is, we know somebody is your fan and they know that you're a fan of puns yourself. So they would like to know, what is your favorite pun?
Okay. So You're giving no credit to the craft. They just come out. They just, like, it's like a reflex or a tick. They just pop out of my mouth. And so I couldn't come up with my favorite one. I was even prepped with this question and I couldn't think of anything, but I will tell you a joke. Okay. Good. Jace, how did Harry Potter get down the hill?
I don't know.
He walked. JK Rowling.
I was trying to figure it out in my head, like, he walked. I don't get it. Was that supposed to be a pun?
Borderline.
That's funny. So there you go. No pun, but good joke nonetheless. So what research do you think is underutilized by coaches in their training plan?
I would say polarization, which is so funny because it's like coaching 101 is that polarized training, meaning that hard days are hard and easy days are easy, is really important. But yeah. I think coaches sometimes get caught up in the idea of giving more work because then it feels like they're giving value, or that easy days should be kind of in the what you call the gray zone. So a little bit faster, but in reality, time and time again in research, that's shown to not really be the case because you're not really recovering, but you're not really getting great training adaptations either for the extra effort. So I think just really paying attention to that is important. And I think, like I already said, the nutrition piece, like I think lots of coaches, especially like high school coaches and junior coaches, college coaches, kind of think that athletes are like, they'll take care of their own nutrition, but just having a good snack immediately after a workout is so important for reaping those training benefits. And I think it's probably overlooked because people just don't realize how important it is.
Yeah. As I see a lot of college athletes, like they don't bring a recovery snack to the track or to the place where they work out, and then they have to drive, you know, 30 minutes back across town and then get something together where they should bring it with them. I have a follow-up question from me on the polarization. I know, I mean, you coach OCR athletes as well as runners, and there's a little bit of difference there, but they're both endurance athletes at the end of the day. So they both have endurance and they both have strength components to their training, both with, you know, hard strength days and potentially either no strength or easy strength days. Do you stack those on the same like day as endurance? So for instance, when it comes to like polarization, have your heavy lifting and, you know, your hard workout, whether tempo or repeats on the same day, and then having a really easy day like the next day? Or can you recover from an endurance standpoint when you do a strength workout the next day after a hard workout?
It's an interesting question, and it really depends on the athlete's schedule. Like, most people don't have the luxury of being able to train for many hours a day, every day of the week. So we can make this perfectly polarized schedule. One thing we really pay attention to is prioritizing whatever the priority is. So I would never put a hard strength session before a run workout, like a run interval workout, because the run interval workouts are the most important piece of the entire week. Could you do a run interval session in the morning and a hard weight session in the afternoon? It kind of depends on how hard the workout was in the morning. If you're totally gassed and then going into the weight room, you're probably not going to get the gains that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And also the nature of the weight session. If it's more of an activation type thing and a lot of like core and posture and stuff like that, yeah, maybe. If it's really heavy lifting where you're like trying to really, really lift as like as heavy as you can, then you're probably going to be tired and that's going to be impaired. Mm-hmm. So I would probably put it the next day. That said, if they then the next day have another hard workout session, that could be an issue. But I would say for most, certainly for most runners and for most OCR athletes, the lifting isn't, it's not the same as powerlifting. It's not the same as lifting for like pure, pure strength, because you only need enough strength. For runners, the strength you need is a bit of power for running economy and postural stability for injury prevention. For OCR athletes, you just need to be strong enough to get through the obstacles. Yeah. So, you just have to structure the week to maximize the space between things. And that looks different for everyone.
Cool. I call it the minimal viable strength.
Yeah.
So you need good. Just enough to get by so you don't fail an obstacle or you don't get hurt, but no more because it's not going to help you go faster.
It is important. I think it's really important, even for runners who might not think it is, but you're right. It does need to be the priority.
Yeah. Okay. So another question, got two more from the audience here is, how do you deal with all the snow in Canada in training?
That is a great question, because right now it is minus 15, feels like minus 35 Fahrenheit. Nice. Layers go a long way. Just having good gear helps a lot. Mm-hmm. It's actually very refreshing to get outside, even when it's cold, maybe not this cold, but on a cooler day around freezing, it feels good. It's not that bad. People are intimidated by the cold, but if you're prepared, it's really not that bad.
We also have
a really good facility where I live. We have a 454 meter track
around the
skating rink. So that's just pure luxury.
Yeah. What's the coldest you have ran outside in?
Oh my God. Thanks, Denny, who will be a guest on your podcast in a few weeks, and myself. Yeah. When we were in high school, we were such idiots. we would never run on a treadmill because we liked being outside, because we liked to talk to each other. And this one day, the two of us and our third little best friend went out and we froze ourselves so hard that I remember Faye being under a faucet thawing her elbow because she had frostbite on her elbow. And Nadia, the other girl, has frostbite scars on her ankles. And I think my nose was it must have been 30 below. It was so dumb. We didn't see anyone outside that day.
I've only got frostbite once, and it wasn't necessarily because it was so cold. It was cold, but I would have been fine, but we got lost on the run.
Oh no.
So it was like then it got dark and we were running through pastures and then we got turned around and ended up at a farmhouse, but that's a story for another time.
So, that's awful.
so last question here from the audience. What do you think is the most valuable habit that you have as an athlete?
Consistency. So I'm committed every single day to doing what I need to do to progress my craft, I guess. Even if that's rest, that's still a commitment to progressing. If I'm injured, I'm cross training, I'm rehabbing, but just consistency to whatever goal I'm trying to reach.
Awesome. Cool. So if somebody's listening to this and I need more Jess O'Connell in my life, or if they're interested in your coaching for either OCR or for running, let us know. How can we connect with you? What's the best way to reach out?
Yeah, I'm most active on Instagram. So I'm at Jess M. O'Connell. Share lots about my running and my life and the ice cream I'm eating that day. My coaching Instagram is at @grit_coaching. We share a lot of training tips and athlete stories, stuff like that. And you can find my coaching site at www.gritcoaching.net.
Cool. And I'll have all links of that in into the show notes as well. Last question, then we'll say goodbye. What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
That's too hard. It's like, I really like that really like luxurious, like high quality craft ice cream. So I go to those like fancy stores where cones are like $5 a cone and nice. Whatever creative creation they've created is what yeah. I want.
Yeah. But like local birthday cake. Okay. cool. Well, it was great having you on the show, Jess.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was a great chat.
All right. See you later.
Bye.
All right. Episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jase, J-A-S-E, @scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.